Welcome to the AI Policy Podcast, a podcast by the Wadhwani Center for AI and Advanced Technologies at CSIS. I'm Gregory C. Allen.
And I'm Andrew Schwartz.
Join us as we dive into the world of AI policy, where we'll discuss the implications of this transformative technology for national security, geopolitics, and global governance.
Greg, it's good to be back with you. There's a lot going on right now in AI policy. Today, we're going to talk about the first of their kind policies, ranging from legislation passed at the state level in Tennessee to bilateral agreements between the US and the UK. But before we dive into the specifics of all of that, I want to ask you, how should we be thinking about this growing web of AI regulation?
Well, welcome back, Andrew. It's great to have you back. The way that I think about this is there are three different sort of eras in modern AI technology, and most regulatory approaches are going after one of these different eras, which I call sort of the horizons of AI technology. So to begin, the modern machine learning revolution, really the deep learning revolution, you could sort of debate the starting date, but I would say the starting date is 2012, which is when deep learning techniques absolutely crushed the competition at the ImageNet competition by combining deep learning neural networks with GPU computing technology. And at that moment, basically the entire AI industry was born, and every big tech company realized that neural networks combined with GPUs was the future of machine learning.
So about 12 years ago.
Exactly. And those 12 years, from 2012 to 2022, is really that deep learning revolution, which was a really big deal.
But what it really accelerated, though, is in the last couple of years, correct?
Indeed. And I even hear from folks, and this is just completely wrong, that AI wasn't even a thing before 2022.
Yeah.
I was writing AI policy papers, you know, in 2015, 2016, 2017. The White House under the Obama administration was publishing papers in the 2016 timeframe.
Well, not to mention, I mean, guys like Eric Schmidt have said that they were studying this stuff in the 70s and nobody really cared about it back then, but now they're really on top of it.
Exactly. So the date that I'm using is starting from the deep learning revolution, and even deep learning has some important historical precedents decades prior. But when it really hit its stride is 2012. And so from 2012 to 2022, that's when we're riding that deep learning, machine learning, technological wave. Then in 2022, and even though, again, here there are some historical antecedents before 2022, that's the ChatGPT revolution, which we can call the generative AI revolution. So not just AI systems that can recognize what's in a photo, but can generate images just from text prompts, and similarly generate text from text prompts. And that is sort of the era that we're in right now, from 2022 to today, where these generative AI models are incredibly capable, are doing stuff that folks thought was impossible or much, much further away than it currently is. And that is also like one of the things that regulators are trying to wrestle with. What do they do with generative AI? And then the final horizon, as I'm calling it, is in the future, what are called frontier AI models. These are systems that are not just a little bit better than today's generative AI systems, but might be 10 times better, 100 times better, 1,000 times better. And the regulatory challenges of something that is not just application specific, but really general purpose intelligence applied to a ton of different applications, the regulatory challenges for doing that are much, much harder.
And you know, you've seen our politicians really embrace this in a way that maybe they didn't embrace the social media revolution initially.
Yeah. And I think that these three horizons are sort of helpful for understanding what has been going on in AI regulation and what will be going on in the future. So the European Union AI Act, for example, they were originally talking about how to regulate really the deep learning revolution, that era of 2012 to 2022. And then in 2022, when the generative AI revolution happened, they realized, oh my gosh, there's this entire additional approach to AI technology that has some pretty different industry dynamics. Some of what we were working on still applies, but we probably need some other tools in the toolbox to go after that. And then you see other major initiatives like the UK AI Safety Summit last year, which got together global leaders to discuss these issues. That was principally focused on these frontier AI models. And so what I think is really useful as you're considering AI regulation is which era or which horizon of AI technology is this regulatory approach intended to tackle? And that sort of helps you understand what they're trying to accomplish and why it might or might not be successful.
All right, can I ask a really dumb question?
Please.
Do we have enough expertise in our government to actually regulate this stuff? And when I say our government, I mean Congress and the administration.
If there is definitely a shortage of AI policy expertise on planet Earth, not just in the United States
so
government.
So it's definitely in the United States government.
Yes, and you're seeing behaviors coming out of Congress that are really remarkable. My own congressman, Congressman Don Beyer of Northern Virginia, he is taking night school classes at George Mason's University to get a master's in artificial intelligence.
Famously in this area, everybody knows about his night school.
It's a really impressive commitment, you know, from somebody who's not exactly, you know, drowning in free time being a congressman. But Congress is dedicated to learning on these issues. It's a really encouraging self-education and bringing in experts to brief them kind of a thing. And the same is true on congressional staffers. The Stanford HAI Institute, which is the big Stanford AI think tank, they run a congressional boot camp every single year to try and get congressional staffers up to speed. And then we at CSIS do our own training events for government officials in the United States government and in governments around the world on this area. So there definitely is a shortage of AI policy expertise. That's why it's so good to run this podcast and all the efforts to try and address the shortage.
Well, you know, another thing, just in the last couple of days, I learned about this because the Wall Street Journal reported on it. Business schools are actually really encouraging, not even encouraging, but requiring their students to become really proficient in AI. A great example of this is, as the Journal reported, Dave Marchick, who's the dean at the American University's Kogod School of Business, has mandated that this is something that his business students need to understand and learn. And that makes a lot of sense because the future of business is wrapped up in this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a MBA graduate myself. I came out of Harvard Business School, Harvard Kennedy School back in 2017. And around that time frame, it was a big deal that CS50, Computer Science 50, which is a very popular course at Harvard University,
This is the one the guy teaches online mostly and tells his students, don't come to the auditorium, it's so much better online, and he does a really interesting performance there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've attended it both in person, and then you also can have the online version if you want, but it was a really impressive course, and it was very popular at the business school. And, you know, my programming and coding skills are not going to impress anyone, but it was really helpful to understand sort of the fundamentals of the technology and how it works. And now you're seeing that same sort of insight that was started with traditional software programming, recognizing that the same is true of machine learning and artificial intelligence.
So, you know, what my kids say, Greg, when someone drops that, like, they, you know, went to Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School, they say that's a soft flex.
Well, you know, it was a great program and I have no regrets.
We're very proud that you're alumni of there because you've now brought all that expertise to CSIS. Let's start with some of the landmark news, though, in AI governance. On April 1st, beginning of this month, the U.S. Department of Commerce announced the world's first bilateral agreement with the United Kingdom on the testing of advanced AI models. Can you give us a brief overview of this agreement and how does the agreement build on the outcomes of November's UK AI Safety Summit?
I think the right way to think about this is as an outgrowth of what was agreed to in November. So with the UK AI Safety Summit, that's when the United Kingdom government announced that they were going to create an AI Safety Institute. It was going to have some really prominent leadership, Yoshua Bengio, who really is one of the founding fathers of the deep learning revolution, is leading this organization. And the UK government has committed real money to this institution, about $125 million equivalent. And that is going after principally these frontier AI models. As I said before, right, in the sort of three horizons of AI technology, frontier AI models are those ones that are coming down the pike and are looking like they're going to be a very big deal very soon. And it's important to develop safety capabilities in advance because these capabilities are improving so fast on the performance side. So the safety capabilities really struggle to keep up. Well, the United States has embraced the UK approach. They've created their own AI Safety Institute, and now these organizations are going to be collaborating. So the basic point here is that whatever the UK AI Safety Institute makes progress in terms of test and evaluation for these frontier AI models or these very advanced generative AI models. They want to share best practices there. They want to align definitions and standards to the maximum extent possible. And this seems to me like a really obvious opportunity for collaboration and making the most of it between both countries.
Okay, so what are some of the main risk areas that we can expect to see prioritized in both governments' commitment to testing advanced AI models?
I think one of the more popular areas that is working on existing generative AI systems like GPT-4, like Claude 3, the major large language models, is around red teaming and other sort of safety practices. That is going to be a focus of this type of collaboration, but they're also thinking through what is the next generation of safety technologies and approaches that could possibly be developed. I'm thinking about, for example, technical-based test and evaluation systems. This is a relatively nascent field, and it would be wrong for me to say that I know with great confidence where exactly they're going to go, but I think the point here is that they're going to go that way together.
All right, let's move on to some of the latest news from industry and what it means for AI safety. At the end of March, OpenAI unveiled its new system, Voice Engine, which can synthetically recreate a person's voice from as little as a 15-second recording. Now, as somebody who does a lot of podcasts, this is something that has really caught my attention. I am on the record as speaking much, much longer than 15 seconds. I'm sure you are as well. And OpenAI is yet to release Voice Engine to the public because it's currently testing the system through a small group of businesses to explore the risks that the system might pose. I mean, I'm even thinking, you know, back to my kids, you know, teenagers messing around with this and saying, you know, so-and-so said this about that person, and you can't tell because the voices are...
Maybe it's a deep fake.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, that also gives a bunch of kids saying, you know, fake news.
Yeah. This is what a group of researchers have called the liar's dividend, right? That the actual beneficiaries of deepfake technologies are the people who were already lying and the recording was true. Now it gives them a better opportunity to sow doubt as to the authenticity of the recording. In your own personal sense, I actually think that you're now in better standing than you were before, right? Because you used to be a uniquely vulnerable target because you had hours and hours and hours of podcast audio. Now anybody who has 15 seconds of audio, which is a much larger group of humans, has a similar degree of potential vulnerability in terms of cloning their voice.
That makes me feel better.
Yeah. There's a few things, though, that I want to call out about what OpenAI has done here that I think are pretty interesting. The first of which is that OpenAI, you know, we're currently on GPT-4, the most advanced version of their large language model. GPT-5 is coming down the pike. But this sort of soft launch and looking through the safety risks of the technology prior to widespread availability of the technology, OpenAI actually pioneered that approach with GPT-2 many years ago. And at the time, they got some criticism from the AI community being like, isn't this overblown? Why are you so focused on safety? Shouldn't you just make everything available right away? So they got some criticism back in the GPT-2 days. Now with Sora and Voice Engine, they have replicated that same approach of a soft launch, giving time for safety researchers to play around with the technology, and nobody is criticizing them. Right, that approach, I think, has really borne out as a really lovely bit of responsible behavior, which isn't to say that everything's going to go great, but I just do think that that approach, the mindset in the AI community has really shifted there.
What do you see as this being really useful for?
I think the main use is going to be entertainment, frankly. I mean, it's fun to play around with creating voices.
Well, and musicians are already up in arms about it. About 200 of them, you know, released a statement just days ago saying they're very worried about their intellectual property given the risks of AI.
Definitely. And there's already been some precedent that, you know, what the Voice Engine is doing is really lowering the barriers to entry for doing this voice generation technology. This has already been available to folks who have some programming chops and a little bit of understanding about what's available in the open source AI community. But now this is going to be available in a much more widespread use case. I mean, I was originally talking about deepfake voice generation with Lyrebird, which was a startup back in the 2017 era. So this is a familiar technology. This is a familiar problem. What OpenAI is doing is making it vastly more available to a much larger group of people on a much smaller training data set. But at the same time they're doing that, they're making sure that their version of it includes some safety mechanisms built in, such as watermarking. Watermarking basically means that there are digital markings embedded in the audio file itself or the video file or whatever it is that are designed to facilitate the detection of this as an AI-generated content. Probably not detectable by the human eye and the human ear, but for automated programs that are looking for this type of thing, it makes it very, very easy to find what is the actual origin of the audio and whether or not that was done with AI. I think this makes a lot of sense. Because OpenAI is really reducing the barriers to using these technologies, which, as I said before, were sort of already available to groups who had some technical chops. But when they make it more widely available, they're making it more widely available with these safeguards built in. And I think that makes a ton of sense.
So how do you see this issue progressing? Will OpenAI, you know, eventually they're going to get this technology out there. There's some risks, clearly. How do you see it developing?
I think there are going to be some bad actors who attempt to make use of this technology, just as there have been bad actors making bad use of prior versions. We talked in the earlier podcast about the fake Biden robocall
right. In
the New Hampshire primary. This type of problem is going to be more widespread as the technology gets more available. So I think it's helpful that the most widely available versions of the technology have safeguards built in. The problem is some folks will claim that stuff that is true is a deepfake, and some folks will believe them. So even if there are widespread, you know, technical authentication means, are they getting in front of audiences in the relevant time frame?
Right. And this muddies the waters a little bit where you don't know what to believe, whether it's real or not.
Yeah, I think there's a Mark Twain quote. I hope it's Mark Twain, but you know, a lie gets around the world before the truth gets its pants on.
Yeah.
And that is a real problem here, because now these lies are not just claims, but they're claims backed up with some pretty compelling media content.
And they're supersonic. They really get around fast.
Exactly.
Greg, have we seen any recent legislation seeking to regulate these issues at the state level?
This is what is so difficult about tracking AI policy, is that there's really important things going on at the international level. There's really important things going on in Congress. There's really important things going on at the White House. And there's really important things going on at the state level. So on March 21st, Governor Bill Lee of Tennessee signed a first-of-its-kind bill to ban the use of AI to copy a performer's voice. This is really interesting because it sort of shows that people who are creating this type of content are going to have to deal with what might be a fragmented regulatory landscape. What is legal in Tennessee? What is legal in the UK? What is legal in Asia? So on and so forth. And enforcing these types of regulations is going to be tough because stuff moves around the internet pretty freely. But the companies are potentially facing big fines or big lawsuits if they can't figure out how to get around this. And so I think the Tennessee bill is interesting because I think we should expect to see more of this in the future.
And clearly this is coming because the recording industry in Nashville is coming out of Tennessee, right?
Oh, I actually hadn't thought of that, but you must be right. That's got to be what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about policy at the federal level. At the end of March, the White House, under Vice President Kamala Harris, announced that the OMB, Office of Management Budget, would undertake a government-wide policy review to advance governance, innovation, and risk management in federal agencies' use of AI. What problem was the OMB's policy created to solve, and how does this policy fit into the vision of the Biden administration's executive order on AI?
This is a pretty big part of the Biden administration's executive order. And while, you know, OMB guidelines might not seem like the most interesting thing in the world, I actually think this is quite important for a few reasons. The first of which is that the origins of the EU AI Act are based in some government uses of AI that went tragically wrong. The Dutch government had adopted an AI technology to detect tax fraud, specifically to detect tax fraud in terms of people who are claiming children in order to get the tax credit for having more kids that didn't actually exist. And it turns out that the government agency in the Dutch government that was doing this completely didn't understand what they were buying and totally lacked the ability to do technical due diligence on this tax fraud detection AI software. And they ended up threatening a bunch of people, claiming that they had falsely claimed children who didn't exist when those children didn't, do in fact exist. At the current present moment, the Dutch government estimates that there are thousands of kids in the Dutch foster care system because the families were facing either financial ruin or giving up their kids. And there was like suicides tied to this. It was a really tragic event. It brought down the Dutch government when this happened. And this is a lot of the origins of, you know, why the EU AI Act was originally passed. So the government is very attuned to how could their own agencies be using AI in a way that violates rights or perpetrates harm in the course of normal government business. And they're thinking about this both because they don't want to actually do the harm, but they also recognize that the public backlash that could come if they do use AI in some kind of unsafe or unethical way could be massive. And so that is why this policy, which is designed to say that when the US government uses AI, it must have these safeguards in place if there are these risks in place, is actually a bigger deal than it might have first seemed.
I mean, and this is moving so fast that like one day what might seem safe and ethical, the next day isn't. So you really have to, you know, this is something really important that they're staying on top of, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's a pretty big deal. And while it's pretty in the weeds and kind of tough to figure out what's going on, and most folks might, you know, not necessarily be paying attention to the specific agencies and what specific safeguards they have to have in place, this type of things matters. It's also one of the focus areas of the G7 this year. One of the things that the G7 countries are coming together to discuss is guidance and guidelines around public sector use of AI.
So are there any other key deliverables outlined in this new policy that we should see expect to come?
The big one, I would say, is that by December 1st of this year, federal agencies have to identify whether or not the way that they're using AI could impact Americans' rights or safety. And then they have to implement concrete safeguards around that. That's a pretty vague statement.
I was going to say it's a big job between now and
next
December.
But it's a big job. It's a big job. And, you know, critics of this policy will say that you're basically increasing the regulation that applies in order to use AI in the government at the same time that you're telling the government, hey, you need to be adopting AI much faster.
Right.
And the answer is, yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
Man, what a set of circumstances this is all unearthed. Let's talk about another development, Greg. On the same day as the OMB policy was rolled out, the U.S. Department of State announced a partnership with the government of Mexico to explore semiconductor supply chain. What about this?
This gets to the work that's going on under the CHIPS Act, which is a big investment almost entirely in the U.S. economy. But it actually does have this provision called the International Technology, Security, and Innovation Fund, which has money to actually fund work in other countries. The basic premise being here that
friendly countries, of course.
Friendly countries, yeah. Absolutely, yes. And really strategically relevant countries to U.S. foreign policy and diplomacy.
So like Taiwan?
Well, Taiwan is probably not going to be a beneficiary of this agreement because they already have an incredibly strong semiconductor industry.
Okay.
So this is really thinking about where are some new seeds that we might want to plant in the global semiconductor supply chain so that we have a more diverse supplier base
A
more diverse supplier base of friendly countries.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And when you think about China and competition with China in the semiconductor supply chain, one of the things that China is going around and saying to countries in the global south is the United States government is trying to hold back our development in semiconductors and AI. And they're saying that it's for national security reasons, but actually they just want to be the only rich country and they want to prohibit the development of countries around the world. So this is a really vicious diplomatic message that China is taking around the world. And so what the United States is looking to respond with is actually, it is based in national security concerns with China, and we have nothing against the development of other countries in the global economy. And actually, we want to support the development of other countries in the global economy. So we can help Mexico get a little bit more wealthy, help other countries get a little bit more wealthy in order to build a more durable, sustainable, robust semiconductor supply chain, and also address these security threats that we face with China.
It seems like in the specific case of Mexico, they could get very wealthy from this.
Developing a semiconductor industry is hard, and not everybody can do it. So it's a little bit early to say that Mexico is going to pull this off and this is entirely going to work. But strategically, it makes sense, right? Why you would want Mexico to be a part of the semiconductor supply chain. It has the opportunity to be a win-win here.
What about Canada?
Canada historically has not been a huge part of the semiconductor supply chain. They occupy a few niches. I don't think they're a likely candidate for this fund. It's probably worth saying that during the Cold War, one of the strategies that we pursued was noticing the fact that starving peasants often find communist propaganda pretty appealing. And there was a deliberate strategy of bringing parts of the semiconductor industry to Hong Kong, to Taiwan, to South Korea and other places as part of a economic and technological development strategy to support these countries growing more wealthy, growing more technologically capable, so that they could resist communist influences more effectively. So I think the main target for this fund is likely to be developing economies.
So for those out there who don't think this is about national security, this is yet another example of why it is.
Oh, this is definitely about national security. One final thing to say in Mexico's favor here is that during the COVID supply chain related semiconductor crisis, one of the big problem sets was stuff being backed up at ports. And Mexico, you can ship stuff via trucks and rail.
Greg, let's talk about China for a second because it's always looming over this discussion. According to some more reporting in the Wall Street Journal, U.S. tech giants and Taiwanese manufacturing companies such as Foxconn, who creates AI servers for U.S. companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, NVIDIA, are deepening their investment into new facilities based in Mexico to reduce the reliance on China. So how are geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and China driving this transformation in Mexico, and is it a trend we can expect to see to continue?
Well, right now, Mexico is kind of benefiting from investments in both sides. There are Chinese companies that have actually expanded their manufacturing in Mexico specifically to avoid U.S. tariffs. The New York Times did a profile of the furniture manufacturing sector in Mexico, which has been a big beneficiary as Chinese companies who make furniture look to get around U.S. tariffs by doing more of their production in Mexico. In the case of these more recent investments, you know, we were talking about the semiconductor supply chain, but it's really more the computational supply chain because these chips have to be integrated into computers or data centers, servers, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of these companies are looking at Mexico as potentially a more attractive player in different parts, different segments of those value chains, right? Not everybody is going to be Taiwan and making the fanciest, most advanced chips, but there's a lot of other ways to contribute to this supply chain. And the United States government is encouraging U.S. companies to find a way to expand their ties with Mexico because China is looking to do the same, and we need a counteroffer.
So there's real competition there.
Definitely.
Greg, thanks as always. Great discussion. And we will be back with a new episode very soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the AI Policy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to visit our website, csis.org, for show notes and our research reports. This podcast was produced by David Lotfi, Isaac Goldston, Isabel Burns, and Sadie McCullough. See you next time.